This is John J. York, Eric from the 80s TV show Werewolf the Series, and you're listening to the DETV Podcast.
Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to any and all science fiction, fantasy, and horror television shows out there in TV land. And I'm your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And if you listened to our last episode, we had a deep dive into history and lore of werewolves, and we also talked a little bit about possibly writing a werewolf TV companion book, because there is not one out there. Possibly.
Well, to correct you, it wasn't the history of werewolves, it was the history of wolfmen slash dogmen.
Yes.
Dog-headed men. So it's werewolf adjacent, and it's part of the starting lore of werewolves, but you know, there's a lot in the werewolf topic that I'll be kind of wheeling out slowly as we go through this.
Well, the photo
like,
I post...
Seriously, it could be like 45... It could be like 45 minutes of content, and I don't want to do that to everyone, so I'm going to just parse it out slowly as we go through.
Well, it fits the photo that I stuck up with it on the page and in the werewolf group, if you saw it. It's that classic black and white hand-drawn picture of the werewolf with the, or the wolf man with the baby in its mouth.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
I have, yes.
Okay. So, tonight we're talking about Nightmare in Blue, an NYPD Blue episode of Werewolf the Series.
Season 1, Episode 21, Nightmare in Blue, originally aired January 17th, 1988. While passing through a small town, Eric is shot and buried by a deranged cop wannabe who is murdering vagrants while impersonating a police officer. Alamo Joe catches up to Eric, and Eric convinces him that the phony cop is a serial killer.
It's an Alamo Joe-Eric team-up episode!
I mean, it's a reluctant team-up because Alamo Joe just simply won't listen to anything.
Yeah, I don't understand why everyone loves this character so much because he just does not want to listen to reason whatsoever. I mean, he has seen stuff, he has experienced stuff. Come on. This is just bad writing on the writer's part.
Well, I think when you have this character, Eric has to be elusive enough to continue the season going. Like, Alamo Joe just can't catch him, you know, and be over with. But I also want Alamo Joe to dive a little bit into it so that by the end of the season, they are more on the same side. But, of course, that's not going to happen.
It's just like Alamo Joe needs to get a clue.
This isn't a proper team-up.
Alamo Joe just needs to get a clue.
Yeah. I think he's so tunnel-visioned on Eric being a werewolf, and Eric is the murderer, and Eric is the cause of all of this, that he doesn't even... have the opening of thought for something like there's more than one murderer. Like, there's more than one werewolf. There's more than one killer. There's more than... Like, if he was a true detective and not just a bounty hunter with kind of poor skills, then he would look into all these leads because this is bigger than just Eric. And he should, by this point in time, have come to that conclusion that this is bigger than just Eric. But he hasn't.
The buried part of this entire episode reminds me of a couple things. There was a movie called Buried with Ryan Reynolds. Have you ever seen it?
I don't think so.
It came out in 2009. He's trapped in a coffin in the entire movie, if you can believe that.
Okay.
And all he has is his cell phone, and his battery life in his cell phone is dying. And he was there as, I think he was an engineer working in Iraq, and I think he got captured by terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to communicate with his girlfriend to call the embassy to get help. You know what I mean? Of course, he's buried in the desert of Iraq. He could be anywhere. It does have a happy ending, but yeah, you are trapped in Ryan Reynolds with a box for an hour and a half. And the only other person is the voice on the phone of his girlfriend. And then Spider-Man was buried alive
low
by
budget.
The Hunter. Yeah, very low budget. I don't think Ryan Reynolds is a rising star at this point, but he was not Deadpool yet, you know what I mean? So it wasn't Cricket Mobile.
Mm-hmm.
but this whole buried alive thing, this is a terror fear that I have, too.
Yeah, and, you know, in this episode, it starts, really, with Eric, you know, in one of his many odd, you know, jobs that he picks up along his road, and he's getting, like, an advance on a paycheck, and then Alamo Joe enters, and of course, Eric flees. And then he gets picked up by someone that looks like a cop, has what looks like a cop car, and has a flashing red light on the top of it. So, because Eric says that he doesn't have any ID, doesn't have any money, the cop arrests him. And at this point in time, like, he hasn't really done anything. You know, just walking outside a bus depot isn't cause enough to arrest someone. So immediately there's some sort of suspicion there.
Right.
That he hasn't done anything wrong. But, of course, there's always in the back of your mind that, oh, he knows that Eric is a wanted man, and so he's going to pick him up for this. And I think that's what's going through Eric's mind as he's, like, silently going through that drive that is supposedly to go to the police department. But instead, they drive around in circles and then go to this abandoned house, which immediately, like, okay, this cop is talking some really weird things. You know, the dangerous radar is going off, like, pinging every second because this is not the road to the police department. This is not normal. Something is happening. This is not normal. And then we get to the house, and it becomes evident that this cop is going to kill Eric. He's setting everything up. He drove to a secondary location. He put on some noisy generator, and he is going to kill him. And that's what he does. But he doesn't check the pulse or anything on Eric to find out if he's actually dead. He just starts shoveling dirt on him. And then we see that scene with perhaps Tony rising out of the dirt in the werewolf outfit. And then we see the next scene, Eric is naked, just lying there in the same pit. So he wolfed out to overcome the bullet wounds, the two shots, point blank, and then passed out and woke up still in the house.
The rising out of the ground in the werewolf costume, oh my god, the dirt must have just gotten into everything.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, I will message Tony and ask him about that and see if he remembers, like, the horror of it all, because I don't remember him talking about that when we had him on. But we do have somebody coming on that Tony recommended to us, and when we get that recorded, we will let you know who it is, but it's a close friend of Tony's that worked on Werewolf, and we'll see what happens. The guy is, I have his number, we've been texting back and forth, so it's definitely probably a done deal, because I do have his actual phone number, and Tony asked him if I could have it, and he immediately texted me, and we've been texting back and forth with stuff, and he sent me a bunch of pictures of behind-the-scene photos I have never seen before of From Dusk Till Dawn.
Ooh.
Yes, of him, George Clooney, nice. Quentin Tarantino on the set of the Titty Twister, which is the stripper bar that the vampires own.
Nice.
So, yeah, we'll have to see. But this episode will be heavily werewolf-centered with some tidbits about other things, because, you know, we'll eventually run out of werewolf, depending on what he remembers. But tune into Radio Horror, as I'm going to probably deep dive into a lot of his other stuff. That he's done, not werewolf-related. So, two-part interview, basically, to cover more material not werewolf-centered. Just because we do want to keep the interview very focused on werewolf for this part. But, again, I will let you know who that is coming up. But this episode is...
looking forward to that.
This episode is quick and done. It's very to the point. It does not drag out.
No, and it's very exciting, too, because since we have all these moments of where it seems like it should be going one way, and by the way people are talking, by the movements, by, you know, just the circumstances, it just seems to be danger around every corner. Eric, after he rises out of the pit, he calls the police, because, of course, this is someone, like, if this was a cop, then an internal affairs case would be opened on this. And they would send people out to check out the house and whatnot. But the person answering the phone, I don't know if this cop is just kind of lax in his duties or whatnot. But if someone says that there is a murder, you'd think that the cops would kind of jump into action regardless of the person giving their name. You know, they probably assume that the person calling is the murderer and to send people out immediately to catch this person that is on the phone with them. But no, the cop just kind of, you know, says that there's no cop by the name of Ritter and just passes it off like it's a kook calling into the police department. Our actual murderer for this episode, the character Ken Ritter, which is works for the local news, and he's not actually a cop. He's just a cop cosplayer.
Yes.
You know, his father was a cop, his grandfather was a cop, and now he feels like he has to dress like a cop and clean up the town by killing vagrants.
Correct.
Yeah, and our cop cosplayer for this episode is played by Greg Henry. And Greg Henry is still with us, he's still alive, and he was in the latest Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 as Grandpa Quill.
Oh, that's where I saw him from. Yeah, very, very brief scene. Is he in Volume 1 playing Grandpa Quill before Star-Lord is taken?
Yes.
Oh, that's excellent. That's great they got that actor back for Part 1 and 3. Because, honestly, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, great fourth phase Marvel movie. I know the fourth phase has had some lot of problems, but I love that reunion because it was something Mantis was pushing a lot for. By the way, speaking of the Marvel MCU...
This episode doesn't really have very many people. The only other person would be that officer that picked up that phone, Officer Lopez, who's played by Mike Gomez. And Mike Gomez was in The Big Lebowski as the circus cop. Let's see. He was also in Criminal Minds as Detective Perez. Let's see, Bones as Hector Alvarado. Walker, Texas Ranger, Courthouse. The X-Files, one episode as Jorge Concepcion. And he was in two episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation as Damon Tarr.
Cool. Well,
yeah.
Mr. Zeneca is going to give us some more inside history into the lycanthrope genre history and lore. And then we'll be back with the second episode on the Dead TV podcast of Werewolf the Series.
Welcome, aho. The name of today's episode is Skinwalkers. And since skinwalkers are werewolf adjacent, allow me to spend a few moments to talk about them. 2 points. First, understand that native beliefs vary a lot across the country. It's complicated. And while I'm familiar with the Apache and the Mission Indian groups from California, we're going to talk about the Navajo Nation, the Diné people. Second, I have to say that I'm not an expert here, but I'm going to try to do my best to explain as I understand it from my research and my time with the Native cultures. So, with those disclaimers out of the way, I have one more. There are topics of knowledge that are considered dangerous. There is the concept that you can become corrupted by learning dangerous knowledge. The Nagaloshi, skinwalkers, are a corrupting entity. What I'm going to say is safe because there are mysteries, rituals, details that I just don't know. Only people learning from the elders would get that info. However, if you decide to take this further and travel onto sacred lands, know the risks. You could disappear. Skinwalkers are more closely related with disappearances than leaving a trail of corpses behind. You could also become cursed. What that means varies in who you ask. Spiritual leader Shema Maria Yesbru told me, a curse can be a wasting disease, or electronics just blow up in your hands. So if you're out on an expanse of deserted territory at night, beware of large or odd creatures, like hybrids, eyes glowing in the darkness, sounds of drums when you know there are no people around, whispers from your loved ones, moving shadows, intense stench with no source, or growling just outside your location. Stories of encounters sound ghostly, menacing, and strange. The corruption of the Nagaloshi stays with you. It's a good thing that skinwalkers are an extremely localized phenomena. Skinwalkers reside within the valley between the four sacred mountains. To the north, associated with color and stones of black, is Hesperus Peak in southwestern Colorado. To the south, associated with the color blue and turquoise, is Mount Taylor in New Mexico. To the east, associated with the color white and shells, is Blanco Peak in south-central Colorado. And finally, to the west, associated with the color yellow and abalone, are the western San Francisco peaks close to Flagstaff, Arizona. The Hopi community believes that their kachinas, spiritual guides and gods, originate from this peak. There are two more sacred mountains in the middle of these four directional peaks, and represent valuable goods and hard goods. These are the Hulano Mountains and the Gobernador Knob in New Mexico. In many Native communities, time is a little weird. As it was explained to me, time is a spiral that collapses on itself, all moments happening at once and linearly. The medicine wheel is a spiral. Skinwalkers are unrestricted by time. So, what exactly is a skinwalker? Skinwalkers are supernatural shapeshifters and can originate from a human being, but not all skinwalkers are ever human. As I understand it, they are a spiritual entity of darkness that can emerge from a pocket dimension or from the soul of a trained ritualist. When someone learns the skills and stories of the elders, there is a point in your studies that comes to you in the form of a choice. The apprentice can feel the power of the earth, the ground, and chooses the path of light or the path of darkness. Shapeshifting is a skill that can be a community uplifting experience or can be selfish and dark. It's an astral body shapeshift projection that affects reality and is not bounded by distance. In order to shapeshift, there are rituals, fastings, dancing, and ritual garb involved, like animal skins. These steps are needed to be completed in specific ways that push the limits of human endurance in order to create weakness in the human's grasp of a physical reality. When done by a shaman, this means that they can learn to move at great distances instantly. A little story here. That same spiritual leader told me a story of the time that her uncle walked behind a boulder, started to meditate, and appeared in Chicago. It was an unintentional act, and he couldn't say exactly what happened, but they had to buy him a plane ticket back home. When the path of darkness is laid in front of you, that non-human skinwalker creeps in like an emotional virus and can tempt the practitioner to evil. Killing of a close loved one is necessary to complete the transition into darkness. The shapeshifter wears the skin of the form of the animal that they want to change into. In practitioners with hearts uncorrupted, they can use any animal they want. Animals are thought to be cooperative to aspects of light. In practitioners with dark hearts, they need to choose animals that are prone to corruption or trickery, so coyote skins are most used. Coyotes are known for being tricksy. The spirit of the animal has something to say in how they are used. Rituals to combat skinwalkers include calls to the animal spirit to rise up and destroy their controller. Because time is both linear and not, the skinwalkers of today could be from anywhere in time, forward or backward, and they can never really be gotten rid of. Emotions transform to spirit that affects reality. Matter is fluid. Form is transitory. It is all based on the power contained in the land, so you won't see skinwalkers outside of the rural areas between those four mountains. The Nagaloshi can also be called demons for their spirit-based essences. Murders are not often associated with skinwalkers, but strange occurrences are. Skinwalkers aren't Native American werewolves. They aren't Animagus. They aren't Wendigos. As a side note, Wendigos are from an entirely different area. They come from mid and northeastern Canada, the northern border of the United States, areas known for their harsh and cruel winters. Wendigos and skinwalkers are werewolf adjacent, so there's a lot of overlap in how they're described, since both can take a fairly canine humanoid form. Wendigos are supernatural entities, but are more associated with cannibalism, cold winter hostility, starvation, and death. A personification of the feeling of dying cold and alone and hungry with the desperation of wanting to eat. Skinwalkers, in contrast, are more of a personification of darkness, revenge, anger, and corruptive evil. What type of anger could lead a shaman into choosing eternal corruption for revenge? I can think of no better reason than the Navajo Long Walk of 1864. 4 years of imprisonment in what can basically be called a concentration camp. An ethnic cleansing of the Diné people. For example, 200 Navajo died in the 18-day, 300-mile forced march. 8,000 made it alive to Fort Sumner. 3,000 never made it out. They were returned to their homeland 4 years later in 1868. Then in 1878, there was a Navajo witch purge. 40 people who were suspected of being skinwalkers were killed. It was a literal witch hunt to cut out the skinwalker corruption and restore harmony. But, as I said, skinwalkers can never really truly go away, just like generational trauma never goes away. Today, the topic of skinwalkers is muddled with aliens. which is understandable given the strangeness of the experiences at places like Skinwalker Ranch, a 512-acre ranch in Utah where disappearances, UFO sightings, cattle mutilations, and strange large animals that can't be harmed by bullets have been seen. Is it all related? I don't know. Shima Yasbro taught me that if I ever felt threatened, to stand in my power and say this like a shield that protects you from all harm. Hoshe! It works on animals too. Hoshe! That's it for tonight. Hagone! Good night.
And we're back with the next episode by Televentures Studios, which, by the way, is the name of the studio that pops up at the end of every single episode, and we haven't talked about too much about them. I'm going to be looking them up shortly as Mrs. Zeneca goes over the plot line for the next episode.
Season 1, Episode 22, Skinwalker. Originally aired January 24th, 1988. Eric comes into a town looking for a Skrzeni after hearing about several murders by a Skinwalker. He learns from a Native American medicine man that there may be a cure. In the end, Eric finds out that the cure was a lie, and he moves on.
So Televentures is an offshoot of TriStar Television, which I think now is Sony.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So it's a... once again, people, you're not getting your HD high-definition werewolf release. Somebody is selling one, another bootleg copy in the werewolf group we're in. I neither condone nor support it, only because, you know, none of these people are going to get anything from it. I'm sure, you know, John gets more from everything to do with General Hospital than he'll ever get from this show. But at the same time, you know, God only knows if we'll ever get a release of this from somebody. Funny enough is that since Sony does, I guess, seem to own this, they just announced this past week that the Extreme Ghostbusters, Mr. Zeneca being a big Ghostbuster fan, is getting its first ever DVD release in the United States.
Wonderful.
The 1990s sequel to The Real Ghostbusters. It is, FYI, 13 years late past the original release of The Real Ghostbusters on DVD. We have a Ghostbuster movie coming out in about another week or two, so obviously Sony's like, what do we own we can make some money on from these geeks?
Yeah.
We'll never cover
but,
Ghostbusters
you know, I'll
cartoon.
Buy it.
Yeah, I'll buy it too. We're never going to cover Ghostbusters. There's a ton of Ghostbuster podcasts out there. I'm sure they've all covered the cartoon, so we'll never do it. And we're never going to do the 1970s TV show with the monkey. I'm sorry. Nope, never happening.
You know, it has its charm.
I just assumed that any Ghostbuster podcast would have covered the cartoons, The Real Ghostbusters and Extreme Ghostbusters, probably would have covered the Filmation Ghostbusters with the monkey.
Really?
I think
that they would?
Yeah, I think so. I think because okay. There's a whole history behind it. I'm not going to get into it. This is not the podcast for it. But yeah, I would have believed that they would have covered, you know, some podcast has covered all the Ghostbuster TV-related stuff. And there's been two official cartoons tied to Egon and the gang, and there's been the Filmation live-action and cartoon series follow-up. So, plus there's a Bob Hope movie, I think, called Ghostbusters or Ghost Chasers.
I believe so.
But I digress. Let's go on with our episode.
So this episode takes place in a Native bar. So Native American-owned bar. We don't know if it's on a reservation or what city it's in.
But
the set is just the bar.
They are Native American actors. They are Native American actors.
They are.
Which is...
They are. I did look it up, you know. They are Native American actors.
Back to the Oscar talk. Guess what's up for Oscars tonight? Secrets of the Killers of the Flower Moon.
Excellent.
Yeah. Got nominated for a bunch of stuff, including, I think, Lindsay Gladstone. I think she just hosted Saturday Night Live.
Very cool, yeah. The only actor that wasn't, the only actor that is part of the Native American bar crew, that is not Native American, is the character George, who is actually Asian. Kind of looks Asian, too, but, you know, he's supposed to be a Native American character. And he is played by Patrick Bishop. And Patrick Bishop, he was on Starship Troopers as an engineering officer, and MacGyver as Glass. And, let's see, he hasn't really worked as an actor since 1999, and that was for Starship Troopers and Vow to Cherish, a TV movie. Yeah, and he kind of got out of acting after that.
Very unusual in the 80s to see a lot of Native Americans in the single episode. They're usually kind of off thrown off there and given, you know, kind of very stereotypical, I wouldn't call them racist names, but very stereotypical names that felt like they were overly used sometimes. Big example of this is the actor from the X-Files that helped that helped Scully Mulder with the decoding of the Native American files that were written in Native American Navajo with the alien secrets on them. Werewolves
so
have a
in
lot.
This episode.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Huh?
You said go ahead. I think we're a delay.
In this episode, we have several bar flies, I guess you want to call them.
Yeah.
The guys that hang out at the bar. And one of them is called Jim, who is the first character that we really see, you know, in great detail. And he's wearing a camo jacket and is talking about someone just being shredded. Just shredded. And, you know, we don't really see this character as anything other than a possibly former veteran and a Native American person that has had a lot of experiences, bad experiences with white folks. And you don't really expect the twist at the end of this episode with him. Did you expect it?
No. Just like the previous episode with the maid.
With the cop. Yeah.
Oh, no, I meant, sorry, two episodes ago with the maid.
Oh, with, oh, okay, the maid.
Yeah. Sorry, with Big Daddy, the episode Big Daddy.
Yes. No, in this one, Jim, he is just basically playing the supportive character. We see one person get brutally killed at the beginning of the episode, and then we see his wife mourning him. Alamojo goes to the wife and says that, you know, gives her this picture of Eric, says, that's the person that killed your husband. He has no idea that that's the person. That's just his assumption. And so when Jim sees the picture of Eric at the widow's house, he says, that person was at our bar. And then he goes kind of upset and crazy, and both Marie the widow and Jim jump Eric and beat him up because they think he's the skinwalker. But honestly, that doesn't make sense considering the twist, because Jim is the skinwalker. Jim is the werewolf. Jim is the one who's killing people. Why would he suspect this guy if he knows he's the one doing it? So it's weird. I don't know. Motivation-wise, it doesn't quite seem to make sense. But if he's covering up the fact that he is a shapeshifter, then, you know, that goes along with it a little bit.
And we'll the special effects in both of these episodes, or any of the effects, we'll definitely be able to ask somebody coming up some great questions about. So we'll take some notes about episodes we've seen and episodes coming up, because we have something cool planned with a guest connected to these episodes and more.
In this episode, we also meet a person, Mr. Indochini, and Indochini is a medicine man, or at least he says that he studied medicine in the Native American culture when he was a kid, but he doesn't quite have the skills for that purification ceremony that he was talking about earlier. That character is played by Del Birdie, who has passed on in 1991, but he was known for playing a lot of Native American characters, of course. You know, it's stereotypical in this time period, and you could possibly have seen him as Chief Henry in Saved by the Bell, or as Sun Eagle in Simon and Simon. In Highway to Heaven, he was also Signy Eagle. So Standing Elk is another part of one of his characters from The Edge of Night. So, yeah, he just played a lot of stereotypical Native American characters.
Gotcha.
But he is the only character in this episode that believes Eric, trusts Eric, and wants to help him in whatever way he can, but still, like, keeping a little bit of a knife on Eric because, you know, he knows he's a shapeshifter. And so he says in this episode, a wolf, to catch a wolf? That's exactly what happened. Eric fights with Jim as he turns, and we get this moment, you know, it's really weirdly done, where we get this moment where the widow is afraid. She has a silver knife to protect herself from a skinwalker. She meets up with George outside, and George starts talking in that same kind of way that the cop was talking to Eric in the last episode, in that semi-dangerous, like, something is wrong here. And then George says that he wants to kill all the tribal people. Then it's like, okay, well, this is going to be our reveal. This is the werewolf, you know. He's going to wolf out and transform and kill the widow. But he doesn't. Not at all. And so Jim attacks them at that same moment. So it's like you're getting these dangerous signals from two different parts. And then Jim kind of comes out of the blue and attacks them. And then Eric just attacks Jim, and they fight, and, you know, Eric wins.
And then our episode ends, because they always do. Little heart-to-heart, yeah. And then that's it. It's just, boop! Da-da-da-da.
Yeah, we don't see Alamo Joe after the winning. You know, we don't see him. We see him in the moment where he almost shoots Eric as Eric is transforming. He almost shoots him, but Mr. Indochini stops that from happening, and we don't see Alamo Joe for the rest of the episode, so we don't see how Eric got away from him after the conclusion of the fight. One of the characters, the bartender, a character named Roosevelt, is played by Henry Kingi, and he is, for the most part, a stuntman. He has done a lot of, like, bit part acting, but for the most part, he is just a stunt driver, a stuntman, done stunts on so many movies. So just like Tony Snegoff, like, he has over 200 credits on his IMDb for stunts alone. Everywhere from, like, the Fast X, which just came out, to Venom, War Dogs, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Like,
so some good things, some bad things, huh? I'm not a Fast and Furious fan, and I was not a big fan of the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Animation I thought was beautiful, otherwise, eh.
Yeah.
By the way, Godzilla Minus One won its Oscar.
Excellent. Best, I love that.
Best visual effects. It was the big one they really wanted. By the way, that director of the film gets that Oscar. He is the first director since Stanley Kubrick to win the Best Visual Effects Oscar.
Wow.
Who directed his own movie. The director of the visual effects team is the director of the film itself. He is the first director to win that Academy Award since Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey.
Wow.
Yeah, big deal. Big deal. So he gets an Oscar for his effort for that movie, because that movie is incredible.
So I do want to make a couple comments on this episode regarding, like, the Native American culture expressed in the episode. And
how on point and accurate it was?
Yes. Like, I will say that I don't have any serious issues. In the beginning of the episode, they use the words counting coup for...
They use the word what? Sorry, you broke up really badly as you were saying it.
Oh. They use the words counting coup.
Okay, what does that mean?
Okay, so in the beginning of the episode, this person that ends up being killed a bit later has this new job. He's going to be this big promotion for a contractor. And so he's asked if he's counting coup. And counting coup is a way to show that you have faced something brave, you have done something incredible, and that in some tribal communities, you would get an eagle feather to add to, like, a cloak or some sort of attire to show that. Like, an eagle feather is the way that you would kind of mark your coup. And how you would count coup is by doing these brave acts. One of the acts that I've been told is a way that you can count coup is that during a battle, during a war scuffle, if you take your staff and you hit the head of your opponent during the fight, meaning that I could have killed you, but I didn't, that is a way that you could earn coup. Basically, by facing your fear and doing it, but then not inflicting harm on your opponent, you're showing compassion. And that's how it was explained to me, how to earn your coup, to earn your eagle feathers. You need to to display that, to really prove that you're able to be a leader of the group and support everyone regardless of their station.
Wow. Okay. Wow. I didn't know that all meant different things, the feathers and all that stuff. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I don't
deep
dive into a lot of Native American culture unless I need to, so that's interesting. Excuse me.
Well, my ex-husband followed the Native American path, Snake Clan Apache, for a very long time. I mean, he's still in there, but we're not together anymore. So I did learn a lot, and I do have a Native American name and everything. So
cool.
I was kind of deep in that culture for a little bit.
Well, that's all the notes I have here for these two episodes of the Dead TV Podcast.
It's all the notes I have.
Rather unique, different episodes, each one. One's a cop story, one's a Native American story.
Yeah. I like these two.
These weren't bad.
These are very interesting.
Except for Alamo Joe being the worst bounty hunter since.
Well, at least in these two episodes, he shows that he actually did some sort of tracking of Eric. He did find him at the bus depot where, you know, no one would have known he would have been. So he does have some sort of tracking skills that work occasionally.
I was going to say he was the worst bounty hunter since Dengar. As a deep dive reference for you. don't forget to find us on the Werewolf TV series group. That's where the Dead TV Podcast has been for quite some time. Even before we started covering this, but I've been on there as well, because my old interview with John twice over. John did another interview with someone else. Oh, it makes me very angry. I held on to that for so long, and someone else got him a couple years ago. So, anyway, I digress. you can also find us on Twitter at ChristySAV and Elegantly Kinky, where we both posted about this week on Twitter that Facebook crashed and burned for a little while. I don't know what happened there. You can also send us an email, thatradiopart@gmail.com. I did get an email from somebody, and asked one question in the email. Why don't you guys do more popular shows? I don't know what that means. I was like, what does that mean? I mean, Friday the 13th is cult. But the Addams Family is probably the most popular show we've ever done because it's the Addams Family, and it was a popular show. It was not a lackluster in the ratings. The Addams Family was huge.
I think they possibly mean popular shows of today, and the reason that we don't do that is because there's a lot of other podcasts that do that.
Right.
We don't want to do shows where other podcasts have already done all of the illustrations, the deep dives, going into the cast and the crew. Like, all of those shows that are more popular have dedicated podcasts to them. And we try to go after the ones that need a little bit more activity. You know, these are the shows that were great, but just could be lost to time if we don't continue talking about them.
And the two shows that we did the two shows that we did that were set in like the 2010s was Dracula and Constantine. And what's funny is that one of those shows replaced the other one. I don't remember which one came first, but one was canceled and the other one came in its exact same time spot and then got canceled as well, which is, I think, hilarious that we covered both of those. I wanted to do The Exorcist, but I don't want to rewatch the second season. The first season I think is great. The second season is like, ugh, what are we watching after a while? It's just, I see why it got canceled. That's the only other new show other than Powerless, so.
Well, and we did Reaper, and that's 2007.
Oh, right. I guess Reaper is pretty modern because they were under all their modern acronyms and cell phones and technology and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
They're so modern that all the actors are actually successful, so we can't get them on the show.
No, can't. tried several times with Ray Wise, but it just was not happening. But I digress. I guess we'll do Blade if Marvel ever gets the movie going. We should just do Blade and say to hell with it, you know what I mean? will we have to cover the three movies before it? No, there's three movies. Unlike War of the Worlds, it was one film tied to the series. Blade has three movies.
First Blade movies is really worth watching anyway.
Well, the problem with that, Mr. Zeneca, is that they pick up a plot line from the third Blade movie for the TV show.
Oh.
Yeah, a new form of the serum that Blade gets is mentioned, including the woman who developed it, played by Natasha Lyonne, from, what's that, Russian Doll? Is that her show on Netflix? Right?
Yes.
She plays a blind scientist in the third Blade movie, and she helps come up with a new formula for Blade. And the first episode, the pilot of the Blade show, his new handler, this Asian guy, mentions her name and the serum, and he has to go back to the old serum. Because she was killed in the third film by Dracula. So, yeah. I don't want to cover all three movies before we cover the TV show. So we can just kind of give it its own, like, whatever. You know what I mean? We don't have to rewatch them. So we can always just kind of recap what happened in the movie in the pilot episode. So, but, again, I'd like to do Blade sometime. I actually really enjoyed that show. So I think we're just holding on forever for Marvel to get a film done 5 years later after they announced it. Yikes. But I digress. And we're on Facebook as well as our own page, The TV Podcast. And we'll be back in a couple weeks with two more exciting episodes of Werewolf the Series. In fact, I think these two episodes coming up. The series changes a lot.
All right. Good night, everyone.